My name is Bob Ruff, and I am the host of the Truth and Justice podcast. I have been a firefighter since 2001. I started off as a volunteer firefighter, and then I worked full-time for Niles Township here in Michigan. Moved my way through the ranks there up until I was the lieutenant and acting chief when I left there to become the fire chief of the North Berrien Fire Department in 2012. I served my last 3 years in the fire service as the fire chief at North Berrien, and where I took an early retirement January 1st this year to work full-time on the Truth and Justice podcast. And through my 15 years in the fire service, not only did I serve as a firefighter, but I was also an arson investigator. I was also the director of fire science for Southwestern Michigan College, where I taught fire cause and determination along with some other classes.
Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Listen to the heartbreaking true accounts of wrongfully convicted people and their journey to exoneration. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you for joining me for episode 16 of Actual Innocence. To be honest, I can't believe it's just been over 4 months since this podcast began. Today's episode is a little bit different. It will start with an interview from an expert and end with me answering questions from listeners. I've noticed that I get a lot of questions about different areas of science that were used incorrectly during a trial. And recently, I've had 2 separate stories about arsons that were, in fact, not arsons at all. These stories led me to reach out to a definite helper for the cause of truth and justice, Mr. Bob Ruff, a former fire chief. My interview with Bob will be up right after we talk about today's sponsor, Stamps.com. I love crossing things off my to-do list. It's a great feeling. I specifically love the feeling that I get when I can do something with just the click of my mouse. It can't get more convenient than that. And now we can get that same satisfaction through mailing and shipping items right from our desks, thanks to Stamps.com. Stamps.com turns your computer, PC or Mac, into your own personal post office. And the best part? It never closes. I'm kind of a night owl, so that's perfect for me. It's so convenient that we can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using our own computers and printers. You'll never have to go to the post office again, so you can spend that extra time crossing things off your to-do list. I wanted to do a test to see how much time Stamps.com was really saving me. So I printed a stamp for a thank you card I needed to mail to one of my Patreon subscribers. It took me just under 3 minutes to log in, print the postage, and walk the letter to my mailbox. Then I took another card to the post office, which is about 3 miles from where I live. When I got there, I realized that everyone must have decided that they needed to mail something because the line was so long. When I got home, it had taken me 47 minutes to use the post office, as opposed to the 3 minutes in which I was able to accomplish the same task using Stamps.com. It's amazing, and I can't recommend it enough. So, right now, you should sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code ACTUAL to get a special offer. It's a 4-week trial, including a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a cute little digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in ACTUAL. That's Stamps.com. Enter ACTUAL. You probably know that Bob Ruff is the host of the Truth and Justice podcast, of which I am a huge fan. When Bob invited me to his studio to do the interview, I was so honored. I'm going to do something that's not the normal for my show. I'm just going to play the taped interview, no voiceovers. More information about my interviewing style will be in the Q&A section. But for now, here's my conversation with Bob. In several cases that I have presented lately,
people have been convicted of arsons that weren't arsons at all. They were just fires. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, what are the first steps in determining if a fire was an arson?
The way that happens most of the time is from an overzealous arson investigator. Because our steps, people call it arson investigation. I call myself an arson investigator. But really what we're trying to do is determine cause and origin of the fire. And so the difference between arsons and other crimes is that in most crimes, you know that a crime has been committed, right? So someone robs a bank, you know that the bank was robbed, and you're left with only trying to figure out who robbed the bank. With arsons, it's a different story because you know there was a fire, but you do not know if it was an intentionally set fire. So you have two steps. First of all, you have to figure out, was there a crime committed? And then secondly, who committed the crime? So typically as fire investigators, the first thing that we're trying to do is determine the point of origin of the fire. That's critical. I mean, we have to reconstruct this scene to figure out what happened. So the first thing we need to do is figure out where the fire started. And then the second part is to figure out how the fire started. So that's the basic part of the investigation. That's what, you know, you hear people talk about arson investigation being junk science. It's really not if people are doing their job correctly. It becomes junk science when people try to prove things that they cannot prove, which a lot of times you cannot with an arson.
So say there is a fire and the police think that maybe it's questionable that it might have been an arson. What would the clues be that it might be an arson?
The basics that we're taught in arson investigation is something. There are classes that you can take. There's different tracks of education. There's state schools like here in Michigan where you can go and get certified as a state certified arson investigator. That was not my track of education. My track of education was through the college for my fire science degree, where I went through my schooling to learn to do it there. But it's not a state certification. But the majority of it, in either case, is on the job training. You have things that are being passed down from one fire investigator to another throughout the years, and so that's how you learn how to investigate fires. Is basically just doing it. So, but there are things that are passed down as far as indicators of arson, and you know a big indicator of arson is multiple points of origin. You know, so if I have a fire in this room here in the studio and I have a point of origin over there in that corner, and then I find a second point of origin over here in this wall, well, fires don't typically start in two places at the same time, so that would be an indication of arson. But that's also something that is misread by arson investigators often. You know, they're not thinking it through all the way. You know, we have something called that we call drop down. So if a fire starts over there, that's my real point of origin. As the fire grows, the room eventually flashes over. There may be things on this wall over here that then catch on fire and fall down. And when they hit the ground, they'll start another fire there. Because we're looking for, we call it low burn. You know, fire burns up, right? Hot things go up, cold things go down. So if you have fire down here right by the floor, that's your low burn. Typically, it's going to be a point of origin. But in this case, it wouldn't be. A secondary fire caused from the first fire with drop down. But that's, people will look for multiple points of origin. Of course, you have accelerant sniffing dogs, but that's also something that is not necessarily reliable. A dog could indicate that there's some sort of accelerant, but without doing scientific testing to figure out exactly what that dog was reacting to, you don't know for sure that that was absolutely, you know, that somebody poured gasoline on the ground. And oftentimes they didn't. I mean, almost everything in this room is petroleum-based. You know, anything that's plastic, which is going to be your carpet fibers, your mattress, your couch, anything in the house, a dog could indicate on that. Not that they always do, but there is some petroleum base to that. So you just have to do further scientific testing with that.
That's really interesting that you brought that up, because I recently did an interview with a man who was accused of setting an arson, and a dog hit on some things in the house where the fire had happened. And the dog handler testified in court that his dog was, this is a quote, 1,000 times more accurate than the lab testing.
I don't know the man's dog, and so I can't really speak intelligently about that because I've never worked with dogs, but I would find that very hard to believe. but you know, that's his dog, his testimony, I guess.
Right.
But yeah, so but then another indicator is the floor is burned, which this is, the other thing is the fire service has evolved over the last several decades, and it's because of the materials that are in our homes. And so remember, like I said, a lot of your training has been passed down from generation to generation to generation of firefighters. My dad was a firefighter in the early 80s. Okay, but he was, when he was a firefighter, they didn't have air packs. They could go into a house without an air pack, hold their breath, and he'd tell me stories about guys he'd work with, and they'd try to pick which window he was going to stick his head out of to throw up. But the fires that I fight now, or that I did fight here in our modern age, I wouldn't make it three steps before I would be dead in that fire. And the reason is because of what things are made of now. You know, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, everything was natural products. Things were made out of wood, cotton, fabric, textiles, things like that. These things burned cleaner. Well, now everything's made of plastic. And so the heat release rate on everything that's burning is exponentially higher than the products that were burning back there. So the fires burn hotter, the smoke is more toxic, the visibility is far lower. And so we get to a phenomenon in fire is called flashover. And what that is so everything, every ordinary combustible has a self-ignition temperature. You know, if I take this piece of paper that you're holding there and I heat it up to 451 degrees Fahrenheit, it will burst into flames if it has oxygen here. It doesn't have to have an orange flame touching it. And so what happens in a flashover is you have, like if you're looking in this room, there's something in that corner over there that's burning. Okay, the heat is going up across the ceiling, and it's banking down. And that's how we get some of these demarcation lines on the walls. We can kind of determine how far down the soot line the smoke is banking. But what it's doing is it's raising the temperature in this room. It's an exothermic reaction that's putting heat into the room. Everything in the room is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And then you have, you look right about this level, okay, the desk, the chairs, the table, the refrigerator, the countertop, all these shelves, they're all about this level, right? So as the heat is rising, everything at this level is reaching 350 degrees, 400 degrees, 450 degrees, 451 degrees. And so all of these things reach their self-ignition temperature at the same time. And basically what happens is they all burst into flames at once. And that means they're putting that much more heat into the room. And so what happens is at that point, the floor is maybe 200 degrees. But as soon as all this stuff ignites at once, the floor now becomes 600 degrees and it ignites. And within 1 second, this whole room is 2,000 degrees for a short period of time. That's what a flashover is. It's basically everything in the room catches on fire all at once. But what happens when there's a flashover is the floor burns. And the floor in most houses now is covered with floor coverings that's made of plastic, which is petroleum-based. You know, your carpet fibers are plastic fibers. So once a room reaches flashover, the floor will be completely scorched. Well, but I've been taught from, you know, my old chief who was taught from his old chief who was taught from his old chief that if the floors burn, that's arson. There's no way for a floor to burn. You know, you have to put gasoline on it or something like that. And it's just not true. If a room flashes over, which, you know, pretty much any major fire, that's going to happen at this point because of the products of combustion that are in the room. So that's one of those indicators of arson that is not necessarily an indicator of arson.
That's interesting because in one of the cases that I had just talked about, they talked about the line, this is quotes, line of demarcation mm-hmm. on the floor, and that how that was an indicator of arson. And so it's interesting because, you know, what you just said makes perfect sense that it probably was a plastic floor.
Right. Now, that's a little bit different, though. When you're talking about a line of demarcation on the floor, if I mean, I didn't see their report, but typically what they're referring to is a pour pattern, which means not the entire floor was burned, but there's a distinct line where it was burned in the floor. And again, so it's like it's burned here, but not here. Well, if it's a true flashover, the entire floor should have been burned. There shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be burnt here and not over there. But again, that doesn't mean that was arson. It's an indicator that you're going to want to look further. I've heard stories, not myself that have experienced, but heard stories of finding, you know, a dog picking up on accelerants and they had lines of demarcation in the floor. It's clearly it was a pour, it was gasoline, and come to find out the guy parked his Harley in his living room you know, for years. That's where he kept his bike. And so there was drips of gasoline or an oil and everything that drips off of a motorcycle there. So there could possibly be other explanations, but that would be, and if you had lines of demarcation in a floor, it's an indicator that maybe it was an arson. It doesn't mean that it was arson.
And because of those lines of demarcation, the lab tested that area and there was no accelerant or anything.
Right. It's just something as simple as, you know, something could have been laid across that floor that just happened to ignite and burn hotter right there. You know, you just don't know. You can't. The key to arson investigating, to make it not a junk science, is not to jump to conclusions. You know, you have to take all the evidence in as a whole. You know, if you're interested, I can tell you a story that was a perfect example of this. So I was the first engine to respond to a structure fire, and this is probably 10 years ago. And it was a taxpayer, so you had a business in the bottom and a rental upstairs or house upstairs, but they didn't use it as a rental upstairs. They used it as office space. And it was actually a Dairy Queen, you know, so you have a restaurant and stuff downstairs and then an apartment upstairs. So we show up on the scene, we kick in the back door. I'm first one in there. So I open the door and I look up the stairs and there's just the upstairs had flashed over. Just nothing but just ripping flames upstairs. Start hitting it from downstairs, work our way up the stairs, fire, put out the rest of the fire. And so then we start to do the arson investigation or the cause and origin investigation into it. And we start to determine where is our point of origin. Well, we find the point of origin was at the top of the stairs. Like literally like on the top tread, top stair, top of the stairs, on the floor. And it was, so then we start looking, are there other points of origin? Could this be drop down? So then you start recreating. In that case, a ceiling hadn't collapsed, so I can see there was nothing on the ceiling to drop down here. And then I find top of the stairs, there's like a little bit of like melted plastic right there, but it's right on the floor. And immediately your instincts tell you this was a set. Because there was also a demarcation line that went down the stairs from there. So it looked like someone had maybe like poured gasoline or something at the top of the stairs and it ran down the stairs and they lit it and left. Everything seemed to fit. We've got you first find your point of origin and then you determine cause. And that's when you start to think, oh, maybe there's a problem here. So you need a heat source to cause the fire. So if I find a point of origin over here in a corner and then I look and there's like, okay, well, there's outlets in the corner. And then we take apart the outlets and you look and there's indicators on the electrical lines that they were short circuited prior to the fire, and there's ways that you can determine one way or the other. But really, the only way to really know is to send it off to an engineer at a lab to really determine whether this was, because electrical circuits short out anyway. It's out during a fire. As things get hot, the insulation burns off the wires and there'll be a short. So,
oh, interesting. I never thought about that.
Yeah. But in any case, this one, it was like, I have a point of origin and I have no heat source. There was no outlet there. There was no electrical there. It's just, the floor is burning right here at the top of the stairs, and there's no heat source here. So that's a red flag. I have this line of demarcation going down the stairs, another red flag. Like, nothing is making sense here. But so then the other piece of it, and it was more what I did that was more, I don't say my specialty, but was interviewing and trying to get information out of the people. So the owners show up, and we start questioning them, like, what was going on, what were you doing last night, like, oh, I was decorating cakes, he was doing paperwork, blah blah blah, same normal stuff. And so of course we don't give them any information. What I always would do with you know, homeowners or whoever that was affected by the fire was literally walk me through your day. Like, I'll walk with you through this scene. Let's see if you still have a building left standing, which we right. did in this case. So she says, okay, we got here, it was 10 o'clock at night, because the fire came in like 3 o'clock in the morning. It was 10 o'clock at night, and I went up and threw a load of laundry in. So I had her, she walks up, and she walks right past, like, I'm waiting to see what's going on here. You know, she walks right past the point of origin, goes around the corner. I walked in, and I threw a load of laundry in with all the stuff from downstairs. So I said, okay, what would you be throwing in there? All the cleaning rags and stuff from the kitchen and all that stuff. So I threw those in the washing machine. Okay, then we do that. I walk back downstairs. We walk back down. I go into the kitchen. I start decorating this cake, and then at this time, I go walk back upstairs. I take the laundry from the washing machine into the dryer, throw it in the dryer, and then I go back downstairs, decorate another cake. I'm getting all ready to go, and then I went back up. So she walks back into the laundry room. She says, I take this. I took all the laundry out. I put it in a basket, and then I set it right here at the top of the stairs, and then I left. And she shows me right exactly where that point of origin was, is where she set the basket down. Now, if I had went into interrogation mode and started, you know, what was happening? What was here at the corner? Why do I have a fire right here? Well, then you don't gain any real information from that. So I let her kind of explain. Then I'm like, okay, now she's told me literally the last thing that she did was put something right where I've determined the point of origin was. So then we start talking, okay, so then in a fire, if it's an accidental fire, you're trying to find out what did somebody do differently. It's like, that's usually the change of routine oftentimes will be what's, you know, I just had my oil, you know, car fire. I just had my oil changed. Well, look, okay, well, they forgot to put the oil cap back on is what right. caused it. So in this case, I'm like, okay, what did you do differently this night? So he's like, nothing. It's I do this every single night. I'm like, well, why do you put the laundry basket at the top of the stairs? Because that's our routine. I wash them, I dry them, I leave them there. Then the person that opens in the morning gets the basket out and they fold it and put it away. That's a routine. Again, what was different? Nothing. Well, the only thing was we were getting ready to go on vacation and I was done with the cake and we wanted to get some sleep. So the dryer wasn't quite running when I left. That's the only thing that was different was I just opened it up. It was dry enough, but because I wanted to get out of here. And then the bells start going off. What do those rags clean? They clean the kitchen. Go down and show me what they clean. We look at their materials in their kitchen. They have all these organic oils that they clean their kitchen with. So what it turned out to be, which is the only time in my professional career that I've seen this actually happen, it was spontaneous combustion. They had wiped down all these organic oils with the rag. They washed them, dried them, which they do every night. But what you change, your dryer at the end has a cool down cycle. When it's done drying, it shuts the heat off and tumbles everything till it's cool. In this case, she took it out before the cool down cycle, so it's all hot and warm. You know, it's hot. It's also still a little bit damp. Because she didn't let it finish, and she smashed it all into that basket. So you have organic oils that are already heated in a damp area that are able to contain the heat in one place. It literally spontaneously combusted the rags, you know. And that is a case where I don't want to say less experience because I'm not exactly all that experienced. I wasn't working in New York City. I was working in Niles, so you know I didn't work 5,000 cases a year. But someone that wasn't really taking their time may have jumped to the conclusion that was an arson based just on the point of origin and tried to make a case again. And that's where you run into the junk science.
I mean, she was very lucky that you took the time to go through that with her because that could have very well been an arson charge.
Right. Yeah. Luckily for her in the state of Michigan, and as part of what I think has helped me do my job better in terms of that is, at least in Michigan, in my experience, prosecutors don't like to prosecute arsons. It's very difficult to get a prosecutor to take it because it is so hard to prove. You know, you're not dealing with, and a lot of times, very exact science. Sometimes I've had cases where we literally did scientific testing to prove arson. I have one.
You need that dog that's 1,000 times more.
Yeah. No, in this particular case, it was one that went the other way. The initial look at it was an accidental fire. And actually, we found out this person had set multiple other fires, and that's why I went back and took a second look. Everything made sense. It was a mattress fire in an apartment building, which is dangerous as hell. Mattresses burn hot, and they will take a building down. And it's an apartment building, and there were people sleeping in it, several units. We went in, knocked the fire out really quickly, and we looked at it, and there was a baseboard heater, and there was a blanket that was like tucked into the baseboard heater. And it was kind of laying between the heater and the mattress, and it was charred all the way down it, and then the mattress was on fire. I started questioning the guy before I told him what happened. He's like, oh, you know, the damn kids, they keep stuffing their stuff into those heaters. And I told him just last night, I told him to stop putting the blankets into the heaters. And I'm like, okay, perfect. Like, open and shut. It was an accident. No big deal. Close out the case. And of course we had our consent to search to go back. And then I got a call from another chief that was telling me that same person has set several other fires. So I went back in to take another look at it. And again, it made sense. But then I looked a little closer and started looking for burn patterns up under the baseboard heater where they should have been. And there was no burn patterns in there. And I started looking at the blanket. I'm like, I don't feel like this blanket would burn. And that baseboard heater should have limit switches on it to keep it from getting hot enough to ignite anything like that. So long story short, we ended up, you know, going through the full evidence collection, taking photos. We removed the baseboard heater. We removed the thermostat from the wall. We took the blanket, all that, and took it to a place where we did forensic testing on it, determined that the flash point of that blanket was thousands of degrees. It was a UL-rated blanket that just didn't burn. Then we would cut swatches of it and try to light it on fire with a torch. It would not catch on fire. And then we both limit switches worked. We determined that the actual temperature that heater could have gotten to and proved that there's no way that it happened the way that it was supposedly happened. What they had done was tucked in there to make it look like it, and then took a torch and burned the top of the blanket to make it look like the fire had run up the blanket. Yeah, so in that case, it went the other way.
I have a personal opinion question for you.
Okay.
Why do you think people lie? Like, I'm stuck on this dog guy.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, a dog is not 1,000 times more accurate than forensic testing.
Yeah, I wouldn't think so.
Do you think that dog handler had malicious intent, or do you think he thought someone was guilty and was trying to put them away?
Probably the latter. I mean, knowing that I have no idea who this person is or the mm-hmm. dog or any of that, but no, the guy probably does believe that his dog is the best of the best of the best, and he probably did believe that person is guilty. And that happens with a lot of wrongful convictions, whether it be arson or anything else. You know, the Edward H. case that I'm working right now, it's ridiculous that they convicted this guy. It's ridiculous that they arrested this guy. But there was a clue at the very beginning that made him think that he was the killer, and it's just blinders on. Once they believed he was the killer, then they would do anything to get their arrest and close their case. And so most of the time when you have wrongful convictions, you don't have a cop that's like, man, I'm going to convict this innocent guy because in a vindictive way. It's typically more often due to laziness or just a personal belief that the person is guilty, and this end justifies the means mentality. Like, well, he's guilty anyway, so however I get it doesn't really matter because he's guilty.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
After this ad will be the answers to the questions I've been sent by listeners. I have to admit, I'm a little nervous about this section of the show. Not because I have anything to hide, but because it's a little out of my comfort zone for my voice to be featured so frequently in this show. Which brings me to one of the questions I receive most. Why have I chose the voiceover narration style that I use in my episodes, rather than just playing the interviews? The answer is this. In the beginning, I didn't intend for it to be my style. It's actually much more difficult than just playing the interview. However, after doing my first interview with Greg Taylor, I realized what he was saying was so much more important than what I was saying. It was his story, and I wanted his voice to be the most prominent throughout the show. And I thought it turned out okay. Plus, with the way women's voices are judged in podcasting, I didn't want judgments on my voice to detract from the story being shared. Check out the comments on your favorite podcast hosted by a woman, and then one hosted by a man, and you'll understand what I'm saying. The question that usually follows is, how did I get started with this show, and why this focus? I think the answer makes me sound incredibly naive. Basically, before listening to Serial, Undisclosed, and watching Making a Murderer, it didn't occur to me that people were wrongly convicted. I'm a social worker, and I believe that people can change their environments if they make a conscious effort to do so. And I wanted to make sure that more people knew about wrongful convictions and weren't living in the same bubble that I had been, so that change could be made. I was also asked about my interviewing process, like where my guests come from, and how long the unedited interviews last. My process usually starts with an email to a contact that I have either at an Innocence Network agency or to an exoneree that's expressed interest in public speaking. In that email, I explain what my show is about and how the interview process works. We set a date and a time for an interview. I prefer Skype or in person, but some guests are only available to do an interview by phone, which is the reason that the interviews have various audio qualities. Before the interview, I send a list of base questions that I'll be asking and remind the guests that if anything makes them feel uncomfortable, that I'm not going to push it. I want to help people, not make them feel bad. Then we have the interview at the scheduled time. The longest interview to date was Greg Taylor, who I talked with for about 2.5 hours. The shortest, I believe, was Andrew Babick, who I talked with for about 20 minutes. It really just depends on how much the person that I'm talking with wants to share. I then cut my voice out of the interview and see how I can help shape the story with my voiceovers. I try to inject myself as little as possible. Like I said, these are their stories to tell. I want to thank Cameron and Lisa for emailing me questions, and also everyone who contacted me via social media. If you have any other questions you'd like to ask, you can email me at actualinnocencepod@gmail.com or contact me at Twitter at actualinpod. That's ACTUALINPOD. You can also make suggestions of guests you would like for me to interview on the show. If you want to support the show, you can visit us at patreon.com/actualinpod or visit one of our sponsors. The show website is actualinpod.com. I feel so honored to have spoken to Bob Ruff for this episode, and I'll play his contact information for you in just a few minutes. I also wanted to say thank you to the team behind Undisclosed, Susan, Colin, Rabia, and Dennis, for getting the Actual Innocence name out there. I also wanted to say thank you to John Cryer for forgiving me for not having seen the Ducky movie. I want to say thank you to Rebecca Lavoie from Crime Writers On for helping me to improve my editing skills. She's amazing. And I want to say one last thank you to everyone who's left a positive review for the show. Thank you for listening to the stories and hearing the messages being shared, and not judging my voice or the way in which I share those messages. I'm not a professional journalist like Sarah Koenig. I'm a social worker with a microphone recording in my closet. And I'm so honored that you've chosen this show to listen to. I'm Brooke. Thanks so much for listening. The Actual Innocence Podcast website is www.actualinpod.com. That's actualinpod.com. Share your feedback and questions by emailing actualinnocencepod@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter @actualinpod. Please show your support by rating us and giving us a review on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, or by becoming one of our Patreon sponsors by clicking the support link on our website. Remember, sharing this podcast and the stories of those who have been exonerated help to fix our criminal justice system.
So the show is Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff, and you can find it on iTunes. The Stitcher link seems to break on and off, but iTunes or right through the Audio Boom app is a good way to listen. Or you can go through my website, which is truthandjusticepod.com. And follow me on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. Of course, I have a Truth and Justice Facebook page. I mean, there's a million ways. If you punch in Truth and Justice with Bob Ruff, you'll find a million ways to...
Yeah, my car seat definitely always stays very far forward.
Yeah?
Just saying.
All right, you don't push it back. How tall are you?
5'2".
5'2". See, she's four. And my mother is 5'2", and she does the same thing. She leaves it. It used to drive me nuts when I'd get in her car because I'm 6'1", so like it would bang my knees. But then like I have other listeners that say I always slide it back. But then other ones that said I used to, but now to do that it's...
Right.
where it used to be just slide it back.
Well, and I said I used to work for the Girl Scouts, and I drove a company van that everybody used, like whenever we would go on a trip. It was so funny because I was the short one. And so whenever anybody else would get in the van and be like, ah, damn it, Brooke drove this van before me, because they'd have to push the seat back.
Cause smash your knees into it.
Yeah, because I just never thought to push the seat back when I was done. I didn't need it back.
Right. Yep. Just like my mom would bitch about the same thing, because she'd get into it after I drove and she couldn't reach the pedals.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. This place that burned was a known drug house.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if could that affect a fire? Like, do drugs burn?
Well, it depends. Like a big risk.
It was a crack house.
And that's, I don't know the ins and outs of how crack is created. Y'all, meth labs were huge. They were something we trained a lot on because of the chemicals they use in cooking meth. But I don't really know about, as far as crack, if, you know.
Good to know.